12. Even though Martin knew he was in medieval England, it didn't sink in until he and Philip walked out into the street. Until that point, he had seen woods, ocean, and an inn. None of those things had changed much over the last several hundred years. Streets, however, had changed dramatically. The street was narrow. People walked right down the middle of it with impunity, wearing lots of leather and lots of leggings. There were no cars, of course, just horse and ox carts. Rather than smelling of exhaust, the air smelled of manure. It was dirty, smelly chaos, but not the kind he was used to. Martin was wearing clothes that Philip had loaned him, a rough woven tunic and heavy pants, fastened with a piece of rope for a belt. He was still wearing his sneakers, but they were dirty enough by this time that nobody took notice.
"Besides," Philip told him, "people are used to a little strangeness when wizards are involved."
Martin was still sore, but food had helped, and the breakfast beer had helped even more. He had many questions, but was trying not to ask them in public for fear of letting the locals, as Philip called them, know too much. He was finding that with all the new information he had absorbed, all the unanswered questions he still had, and the lingering effects of the beer, he was having some difficulty keeping track of things.
"Where are we going again?"
"To the tailor to get you a robe and hat made."
"The tailor," he thought. "There's something important about that. What was it?"
Finally, it struck him. "Say," Martin said, using his nonchalant voice,
"that wouldn't be Gwen the tailor, would it?"
Philip stopped walking and turned to face him. Martin's nonchalant voice clearly made Philip profoundly uneasy.
"If you mean Gwen the tailor, who gave you a ride into town and was so alarmed by your arrogance that she came to get me immediately, then watched as you made a fool of yourself and got hurled out of town in a white fireball, then helped me cart your drooling, vibrating carcass back into town, then yes."
Martin put his hands up.
"Okay, okay, I get your point. Sorry."
They continued walking.
"So, is she your girlfriend?" Martin asked.
"No, she's not my girlfriend. She's a smart, talented young lady whom I've known for many years, and she's got enough problems without some love-struck young wizard trying to impress her like a medieval John Hinckley Jr."
"Who's John Hinckley Jr.?" Martin asked.
"I guess that's before your time. Perhaps you'd know him if he were on The Simpsons. Anyway, please don't bother Gwen. It's hard enough being a woman and a small business owner in modern times. You can imagine what it's like here."
They came to the door of Gwen's workshop. The only thing that differentiated it from all of the other one-story stone buildings was a small wooden plank next to the door, with a needle and thread painted on it with some feminine decorative flourishes. Philip went in. Martin followed. When Philip mentioned Gwen's shop, Martin had pictured a shop as he knew them, with a counter and displays, and perhaps the medieval equivalent of a cash register. Instead, what he saw was a workshop full of bolts of fabric and garments in various stages of construction. There were two small windows at the front of the hut, and really that's what most of the buildings in Ledchurch were, huts made out of piled rocks and dead plants. In the corner there was a work table covered with many pieces of cloth, two of which were partly stitched together with a coarse thread that in modern times would have been considered very small-gauge twine. Gwen was talking to a farmer holding a small stack of folded garments. Martin was absolutely certain that he was a farmer. The man was powerfully built without being buff. His clothes were clean now, but had clearly been very dirty many times. He looked smart, but talked as if everyone assumed he was dumb.
"Cripes!" Martin thought. He might as well be named Mr. Farmer.
"Ma'am, you make the best clothing I've ever had,"
the farmer said.
"That's why I come all the way into town so often. But the clothes you make do stretch out over time, and I don't think it's unreasonable to ask you to hem your own handiwork at a discount."
Gwen was wearing the same charcoal-colored hooded cloak she had worn the night before, but now Martin could see that it opened at the front, like an oversized hooded sweatshirt, cut to the length of a trench coat. The hood was pulled back off of her head, bunching up slightly around her shoulders and hanging down her back. Beneath the cloak, she wore a lilac-colored dress and her petite black leather boots. She glanced at the door as Philip and Martin entered. She flashed her warm, pretty smile when she saw Philip. Her smile chilled a bit when she saw Martin. She took the stack from the man, shrugging.
Sam, you're a good customer and an honest man, so I'll hem these for free this time. But this is a good heavy fabric, and I promise it does not stretch with time.
The man pointed at the bottom of his dull brown tunic. It was a little long, as were the sleeves.
Then how can you explain this?
He asked. Gwen seemed to be at a loss. Philip said,
I've often thought that most of the men's shirts in this town would be a bit shorter and would fit a bit looser if Gwen hired someone else to do her measuring. Someone men aren't so inclined to impress with their posture and flat gut.
Then added,
Good morning, Gwen, Sam.
Good morning, Philip,
Gwen said.
Good morning, Martin. How are you feeling today? Magnificent, I trust?
Sam looked at Martin, astonished.
Is this the evil wizard you vanquished last night, Philip? I'd heard you slew him and reduced his body to vapor.
Philip explained that he had reconstituted the vapor into a purer, less evil version of Martin, much as one would distill mash into liquor. This Sam understood. He thanked Gwen, mentioned that he was off to the cobbler because his boots were causing him discomfort, and left. As soon as Sam was gone, Martin said to himself, as much as to Philip and Gwen,
I may have overplayed my hand last night.
No,
Gwen said.
It was very impressive. I'm sure it takes a powerful wizard to make their flying spell continue to work, even after they've been knocked unconscious.
Yes. Look, I want to apologize for my behavior. I acted stupidly. Thanks for the ride into town and for helping Philip come get me.
Her smile warmed again.
You're very welcome, Martin. We all make mistakes.
Maybe I can make it up to you by taking you to dinner sometime.
Martin ventured. Her smile cooled again.
Maybe not. What brings you here, Philip?
Martin here is going to be my apprentice for as long as he lasts. He's going to need a proper robe and hat.
She stood and picked up her measuring stick from the work table.
Good. That thing you were wearing last night was doing you no favors.
She spent the next several minutes holding the stick up to various parts of his anatomy and mumbling. Finally, she stood and asked Philip,
Wizard robes and hats are pretty simple. I can have it done in a week or two. I'll need you to come back for a rough fitting in a few days. What color and fabric would you like?
Martin raised his hand.
It's my robe. Shouldn't you ask me that?
What color and fabric?
She asked Philip.
Whatever you like, Gwen. We trust you.
Philip replied. Gwen smiled in a way that made Martin want to disagree with Philip. As she took a few last measurements by laying her measuring stick along and, at times, jabbing it into parts of his body, Martin asked,
Last night, why did you tell me wizards have to be celibate?
I didn't say they had to be. I just said they were.
She said without looking up.
Celibate is celibate, whether it's deliberate or not.
A few minutes later, Philip and Martin were back on the street, walking past the townsfolk going about their business.
Look,
Philip said.
I'll forgive you that one because I remember what it was like to be your age. And being interested in Gwen just means that you have taste. But I'm serious. From now on, if I tell you not to do something, you have to not do it. That includes hitting on Gwen. If you're to be my apprentice, then that means I'm your master, and I need to be able to trust you to do what I say.
You're right. I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that, because after watching you for less than a day, I'm ready to issue my first official command as your master.
Martin braced himself.
I'm ready.
Okay. Apprentice, I command you to think. Being a man of action is fine, but you need to think before you act.
That's...
Philip held up a hand.
Stop! Did you think about what you're about to say?
No.
Then take a moment.
Think about what you are going to say, what you have riding on my continued goodwill, and how I'm likely to react to the words you are about to let fall from your mouth like a partially chewed mouthful of spoiled cheese.
They stood in silence for a moment as the pedestrians passed them by. Finally, Philip broke the silence.
Have you thought about it?
Yes.
Do you still intend to say whatever it was?
No.
Excellent! You have pleased me, my apprentice. Well done. I'm delighted at the prospect of all the marvelous things you're not going to say in the future. You know, the less you talk, the more people assume that what you're not saying is important.
They walked on in silence for several minutes. Finally, Martin spoke.
So, Master, where are we going now?
Marty, you don't have to call me Master.
Good.
A simple sir will do,
Martin thought, and did not respond, which delighted Philip to no end.
We're going back to my shop. You can't really do anything until you're outfitted properly, so for the rest of the day you're going to watch me work.
Martin thought for a moment, then said,
I didn't realize you had a shop.
And after another moment,
or work.
We'll discuss the secrets of our profession in detail when we get to the shop. Just remember that nothing in a wizard's life is what it seems.
Martin decided he'd have to be content with that for now. As they walked, Philip pointed out the important landmarks of the town of Leadchurch. The blacksmith, the bakery, the butcher shop. He didn't need to point out the church. It looked like any other mid-sized Gothic cathedral, except that it was covered in lead. They watched for a few moments as pilgrims devoutly touched the church, and came away amazed at how dirty their hands were.
The real show is at noon, Philip said. Bishop Galbraith comes out and tries to stick a magnet to the side of the church. It never sticks.
What does that prove?
That the church is covered in lead.
But anyone can see that. And besides, it doesn't really prove anything. Magnets don't stick to a normal church either. That doesn't mean they're covered in lead.
True, but the church here in Leadchurch is different from other churches in one very important way.
What's that?
It's covered in lead. You see, faith doesn't have to make sense. If it did, it wouldn't be faith, it would be logic. As a wizard, faith is our most important tool.
Just around the corner, they came to Philip's shop. It was a two-story wooden stone building situated with its back to a steep hill, giving the impression that the building was built into the hill. It had a thatched roof and a sign over the door that said, Wizard. On the door, a small sign simply said, Out.
Why don't you live here?
Martin asked as they approached the shop.
Various reasons,
was Philip's reply as he opened the door and entered, Martin following behind him. The front room of the shop was small, with a low ceiling, and was cluttered with weird-looking knick-knacks. There were statues, bowls, jars of fluid, jars of powder, and sparkly rocks. In one corner there was a small work table and a set of shelves. The shelves looked like an oversized spice rack, but along with the spices there were some live plants and a few dead dried animals. On the table there was a mortar and pestle. In the other far corner there was a doorway blocked by a curtain. Philip closed the door behind them and lit an oil lamp.
Now we can talk freely. I'll try to answer your questions as best I can. If I forget something, please remind me.
Philip stood in the middle of the room and spread his arms.
All this is just set decoration. Most of it is stuff I found in the gutter. The only power anything in this room has is the power to confuse. As you learned last night, it's not enough to just turn up, claim to be a wizard, and ask for food. People have to think you're earning your keep. As long as people are sure you're doing something, they don't worry too much about what. I take the occasional gig just for show. Every now and then I appear out of thin air just to remind people who I am.
So, you don't have to work?
No more than a stage magician has to wave a wand and say, abracadabra.
So, what kind of work do you do?
You'll see. I have an appointment for later today. But first, let's finish the tour.
Philip swept aside the curtain leading to the next room and beckoned for Martin to follow. The second room was dark. Thick, dark fabric hung from the walls. On the fabric were crude, finger-painted markings and symbols. To the people of this time, they must have looked quite mysterious. Martin recognized many of them. The Prism from the cover of Dark Side of the Moon, Icarus from the Led Zeppelin album cover, and the Van Halen logo were all instantly familiar. At the back of the room, there was another door, partially obscured by the curtains. In the center of the room was the stereotypical crystal ball on a table. Only the ball seemed to be partially recessed into the surface. A cloth covered the table and extended all the way to the floor.
"Pretty nice, huh?" Philip asked.
"Yeah, I bet this is pretty convincing," Martin said. Philip nodded.
"You haven't even seen the best part."
He walked around to the far side of the table and sat down. He was just visible in the dim light filtering in around the edges of the curtains. There was an audible click, and suddenly a blue light emanated from the crystal ball, illuminating Philip's face eerily from beneath. The light pulsed and flickered irregularly.
"That is really cool."
"You don't know the half of it.
Come look at it from this side."
Martin carefully walked around the table until he stood behind Philip. He looked into the crystal ball, and there, distorted in the glass, he saw blue light and white letters that said, "Commodore 64, Basic V2, 64K RAM system, 38,911 basic bytes free. Ready." Martin laughed out loud. Philip smiled broadly and pulled aside the tablecloth. There, mounted on a tray beneath the table, was a Commodore 64 with the power light glowing red. Next to it was a box with two circular appendages rising from its top, cradling the handset from an old-school dial telephone. They shared a good laugh.
"Wait, you haven't even seen the best part yet. Go back around to the other side and sit down."
Martin sat in what was presumably the customer's seat. Philip's face, the crystal ball, and the hand-painted glyphs were the only things his dark-adjusted eyes could make out. Philip paused and said,
"Now watch as I summon the demons."
He lowered his eyes, then there was a soft clicking noise which Martin instantly recognized as a keyboard. There was a distant, horrifying screeching noise, followed by what could have been the distant tolling of some horrific bell. Then a growling shriek of 1,000 damned souls. The sound subsided and the crystal ball pulsed blue and white for a moment before settling into a brilliant white light. Philip looked up from the crystal ball.
"I am now connected to CompuServe."
When they stopped laughing, Martin shook his head.
"I can't believe you leave this stuff here and live somewhere else. I'd want to guard the computer 24/7.
"I have good reason to live away from my work."
"Which is?"
"That there's almost no real work. Our main job as wizards is to convince people that we're doing important, mysterious things all the time. It's not hard, but the downside is that when people don't know what you do, they don't know what you don't do. If I flip that sign on my door around to say in, within 20 minutes some gormless dung sifter would be in here asking me to magically sift his dung. Even without turning over the sign, soon, I promise you, someone will come knocking just because people saw us come in. The last thing I want is people getting the impression that they can call on me day and night to magic away all of their problems. They need to know that when I'm home, I'm not at work, and when I'm at work, I have more important business to attend to."
"So our main job is to look busy?"
"Yes, and sometimes it takes more effort than actually being busy."
"But still, is it wise to leave the computer?"
"You should get into the habit of calling it the Oracle or the All-Seeing Eye. Anything but the computer. You'll just confuse people."
"And calling it gibberish won't?"
"Oh, it will, but it will confuse them in the way we want it to."
"Fine. Do you really want to leave the Fount of Mystical Wisdom unprotected?"
Philip nodded sagely.
"Martin, you see this door behind me?"
"Yes."
"Walk through it."
Martin sensed a trap. He carefully walked around the table to the door. Philip turned around in his seat to watch. Martin reached his hand out to open the door. His hand nearly touched a hunk of rope that passed in this time for a knob and stopped. His hand couldn't quite reach the door. It was as if an invisible pane of unbreakable glass held him at bay. He explored with his hands. The barrier completely covered the doorway.
If we ever get tired of being wizards, we could make a killing as mimes, eh?
Philip said, standing up. He gently pushed Martin aside, then opened and walked through the door. Martin tried to follow, but couldn't. Philip came back. As he came through the door, Martin could see a staircase beyond, leading upward. Philip reached down and turned off his Commodore 64. The crystal ball went dark. Philip walked back out to the main shop.
If I'm not here, nobody can come into the shop at all. I hope people try, to be honest. It adds to the mystique. If I'm here, as many people as can fit can come into the shop or the crystal ballroom.
Can I set up force fields like that?
Martin asked, his eyes wide.
You'll be able to do it after you've passed the trials.
How many people can go upstairs?
Only me.
Why? What's up there?
Nothing.
No, seriously, what's up there?
Philip lost any trace of a smile.
Oh, seriously? You're asking me seriously what's upstairs? Then I'll tell you. There is seriously nothing upstairs.
Nothing? Or nothing you want to tell me about?
From your point of view, those are the same thing. Now, if you're finished wasting our time over nothing, we have work to do.
You said we didn't really do any work.
No, I said we work at looking busy. You want to do something every day. Preferably, it'll be something easy that you can make a big deal out of.
Philip made sure his powder blue pointed hat was on tight. He grabbed his staff. There was a knock at the door.
Oh, never fails. Someone always shows up right as you're trying to get going. You ready?
Martin looked himself over.
I don't think so.
Perfect! You're an apprentice. You're supposed to look confused. Follow my lead,
Philip said and pushed the door open. A small, filthy man stood there, preparing to knock again. Philip practically toppled him over.
No, sorry, Hubert. I'm in a rush.
The man held up the dirtiest hands Martin had ever seen, beseeching Philip.
Please, sir, it's about the dung.
I know it is. Look, Hubert, we've been through this. I can't use my powers to sift the dung for you. I have other matters to which I must attend.
But Master Wizard, the dung...
Yes, you've told me. In the future, you'll know to check the dung's viscosity before you agree to sift it.
Hubert looked lost.
Viscosity?
Yes, you know. It's... you've been in the dung-sifting business your whole life. What word do you use to describe how easy or hard it is to sift a pool of dung?
Ah, you mean its siftability?
Yes, I suppose I do. I have to go now, Hubert. My apprentice and I must help contain an ancient evil.
Hubert turned to Martin.
Oh, Mr. Philip has an apprentice!
He attempted to shake hands with Martin. Martin, for his part, had never in his entire life wanted so badly to not shake a hand. He considered bowing, but that would only bring his face closer to the hand. He was so off balance that he just blurted out the first thing that came to mind.
Do you really sift dung for a living?
Martin asked.
Oh, yes. The business was passed on to me by my father.
Hubert replied.
You must hate him.
Oh, yes, very much.
Philip growled loud enough for everybody to hear.
Come, apprentice, we must contain the ancient evil.
Hubert said,
You just said that.
Philip grabbed Martin's hand, said,
It bears repeating,
and pointed his staff toward the sky. Like a shot, Philip and Martin left the ground and sailed off beyond the rooftops.
Do we have to hold hands?
Martin asked.
Oh, grow up!